Today's Tesho will be on Case 73 in the Book of Serenity, Kaoshan's Fulfillment of Filial Piety. Introduction. Lurking in the grasses, sticking to the trees, one turns into a spirit. Being constrained and unjustly punished, one becomes a ghostly curse. When calling it, you burn paper money and present a horse. When repelling it, you curse water and write charms. How can you get peace in the family? Case. A monk asked Kaoshan, "How is it when the morning clothes are not worn?" Kaoshan said, "Today Kaoshan's filial duty is fulfilled." The monk said, "How about after fulfillment of filial duty?" Kaoshan said, "Kaoshan likes to get falling down drunk." Verse. The pure household has no neighbors. For long years, staying in sweeping, not admitting any dust. Where the light turns, tilts. The moon remaining at dawn. Where the light turns, tilts the moon, remaining at dawn. When the forms of the hexagram are distinguished, then are established dawn and spring. Having freshly fulfilled filial duty, then one meets the spring, walking drunk, singing crazily, turban hanging down, ambling with tousled hair, who cares? In great peace, with no concerns, a man falling down drunk. So, thank you all for making such an outstanding effort this morning in the Zendo. An hour and a half of no moving. That was really quite impressive, really wonderful. It's a beautiful day, you know, this air, it went down to 12 degrees last night. And I must say I have been enjoying the California weather here in New Jersey. But it was very refreshing to get up and feel that cold, you know. Somehow, you know, if it's in the 30s, it seems cold. But when it gets down to like the 10s, it's actually a different experience. It's almost not cold anymore. It's a different, it's so different. I don't know how to describe it, and probably this is baloney, you know. But it feels different to me, and it's very exciting when it gets this cold. I feel very alive, getting up in the morning and walking out into the cold and then coming into the Zendo. That's really nice. And then, of course, we had the sit this morning. Everybody did a beautiful job. This has been quite a wonderful session. Not over yet, but people have really practiced wholeheartedly, and the results are really quite impressive. So this koan is about mourning clothes and filial piety. If you know anything about Chinese culture, you know that Confucius was quite concerned that people understood their relationship to society. This was really a huge issue for him. He believed that selfishness was the biggest problem, and that basically people had to appreciate their dependence on others in order for human flourishing to take place. And so, you know, one of the things Confucius saw as the most elemental. Confucius saw the family relationship as the most elemental form of relationship, human relationship. And he called attention to the fact that parents make huge sacrifices for their children. That they, you know, they could be out partying, but they have to stay home and take care of the kids. They could be, buying a new car, but they have to spend the car on their kids' dentures, you know, braces. Yes. Do you know the comedian Wanda Sykes? I love her. You know, she doesn't have any kids, and she actually has a routine where she says, "I'm so glad not to have kids." She said, "I have all these friends who have kids," and she said, "Whenever they say kids, I love them." She said, "They always look down at their shoes, you know," and she said, she said to a friend of hers, "I thought you and your husband were going to Bermuda this summer." And her friend called her daughter in and said, "Jane, smile for Wanda." And she smiled, and Wanda could see the braces the little girl had, and the friend said, "That's Bermuda." You know. But on the other hand, you know, I was spending Thanksgiving with my sister, and she loves her children so much, you know, and they have given her so much joy and happiness I think she would gladly give up many Bermudas for her children. My sister didn't have kids till she was 40. She wanted to have kids, and they couldn't succeed because she had waited so long. And then, she, through the miracle of modern technology, she was able to conceive finally. So she had her first kid at 40 and her second kid at 43, which means that she'll be in her 60s when her kids are in college, you know. And yet she is so happy to be a mother. And so Wanda Sykes is happy not to be a mother, and my sister is happy to be a mother. Which is the right path, you know? Well, you know, the Zen view is that there is no one right road, right? That you have to live a life that is in accord with your true nature, right? And that basically people are different, and a good life, a well-lived life, in one case might look quite different from a well-lived life in another case, you know. I just thought it was interesting that Wanda Sykes enjoys not having kids, and my sister enjoys having kids. But, for Confucius, the elemental human situation was, people having kids and having a family. And Confucius noticed that parents make tremendous sacrifices for their kids, and that basically society is built on sacrifice, you know, selfless giving. And he said, "Look, you know, you were kids, you know, your parents gave selflessly for you. You owe them big time. You owe them your respect and affection. You should protect them when they're old." And you also owe it to the continuity of your family to have children of your own and be parents in turn. And he said, if everybody does this, the whole society will flourish because people will acknowledge their debt to one another, and they will not be so selfish because they realize they depend on others. And basically they must, just as they were helpless, they must help those who are helpless, and so on. This is really very noble. I really respect Confucius' teaching very much. This idea that we owe society something is really an important idea. And that we owe the people around us something because we were taken care of is really very powerful. When your parents die in Confucian culture, it's a big deal. You are supposed to go to the grave in mourning clothes, which are made out of burlap, you know. So it's like a burlap is like a very scratchy, unappealing kind of cloth. And so you go to the grave in your burlap clothes, and it's a way of saying we really miss you, we're really bereft without you, and we're really sorry you're gone, you know. And it's important for people to make this public display, and it's also important for them to honor the ancestors, you know. And if you go to a traditional Chinese home, there was always an altar with the parents' pictures on the altar, or the grandparents or the great-grandparents, and there might be the names, little plaques with the names of the ancestors, you know. And this was quite important in Chinese culture, this idea. This was quite important in the West too, before Christianity. If you saw the movie Gladiator, the hero has little figures that he takes out at night, and he makes a little altar, and he takes out the some figures representing his ancestors, and he says, and he talks to the ancestors, and he says, ancestors, you know, I hope I haven't disappointed you today. I hope I've been a good person, and then he kisses them, you know, he imagines them as waiting for him in another world, you know, and that they'll want him to do well, and they want him to flourish, and so on. So anyway, this is the Confucian ideal, and I think our culture doesn't necessarily value human interconnectedness in this way, you know. We put a great deal of emphasis on individual happiness, you know, and basically we don't always get so much emphasis on our social obligation, you know. This koan is about a funeral for one's parents. A monk asked Kaoshan, how is it when the mourning clothes are not worn? See? This would be bad in Chinese culture, right? It would be like your parents die, and instead of showing up in your burlap clothes, you show up like in your tennis clothes, right? Or like in your, you know, tie-dye shirt or something, you know, or, you know, whatever, you know. It would be like appalling to people, right? So a monk says to Kaoshan, how is it when the mourning clothes are not worn? You come to the funeral in tennis togs, right, with your racket under your arm. Okay? Well, I'm going to play tennis right after the funeral. Well, I'm going to play tennis, and just, you know, when we're done here, I'm on my way to the courts. You know? Even here, that would be appalling, right? So Kaoshan said, today, my filial duty is fulfilled. The monk said, well, how about after the fulfillment of filial duty? Kaoshan said, Kaoshan likes to get falling down drunk. So, that's the koan. And the backstory is this whole issue of honoring one's ancestors and honoring one's parents and honoring one's connections to other people. In Asian thinking generally, this is quite important, you know. In the West, we have a different view, you know. So if you study Western psychology, for example, Western psychology says the highest achievement is something called individuation. Basically, like if you look at Maslow's hierarchy, if you studied psychology, you always study Abraham Maslow's ideas, and you'll study Maslow's psychology, and it ends with individuation. So the idea is we're basically like social beings first, and then, you know, if we're successful, we become individuals. So we start out as more or less just a product of society, doing what our parents want us to do and being what our parents want us to be. We fit in. You know, we all, you know, do the same things as we're growing up. We try to be, you know, normal. We try to fit in. And then the goal is finally at the end to be a true individual. And that means different from everybody else, but your own self, your own person. And so, you know, in the Western way of thinking, the problem is that we are social beings who must somehow get out of society and be free individuals. Now, the Eastern view is the very opposite view. It's the view that we are isolated and that we need to become social individuals. See, it's the very opposite. So basically the problem for the West is freedom. And the problem for the East was isolation, right? And so Western psychology says you must become an individual. You must break out and be free and fulfilled as an individual. And Eastern, somebody like Confucius says the real problem is that people are just so damn selfish, you know. They need to realize that you can't get by yourself. You need other people. And so, you know, this is the opposite sort of psychology. I remember reading many, many years ago about a Zen community in California, which was a mixed group. It was basically made up of Japanese Americans and Japanese people and non-Asian Americans. And at the end of the sesshin, all the people who came to the sesshin were asked to stand up and say something about what the sesshin meant to them. And the Americans would all stand up and say things like, oh, this was so wonderful. You know, I feel so fulfilled. I feel like I'm walking on air. This is great. You know, I feel tomorrow is going to be a whole new ball game. I'm a new person. And the Japanese people would stand up and say, I realize now that, I've gotten too big for my britches. I need to take better care of my kids. I need to be a better wife. I need to be a better husband. I have to work harder at my job. You know, it's like the opposites, you know, the opposites. They both came away from the sesshin experience with very different understandings of what a sesshin is supposed to do. Now, you know, it's possible to say that one of these two models, since neither of these models really fits together very well, it's possible to say one is right and one is wrong. So, you know, when you look at Western culture, you really do see like an epidemic of selfishness and self-centeredness, you know, almost like narcissism. So people are hugely, hugely into personal fulfillment, and they don't think much about the common good. You know, this is just a fact. And people don't want to raise taxes to fix the roads or pay for schools, because they want that money to build a bigger house, for example. You know, I remember growing up in the '60s, where there would be people who, I knew this guy whose name was Mr. Abrams, and Mr. Abrams had worked for the government for about 25 years, and he just decided he wasn't going to work anymore. And he decided he was just going to hang. And he told his wife, look, you'll have to be the breadwinner now. I'm going to read philosophy, you know. And that was the end of his career, you know. So we would always see Mrs. Abrams looking a little tired, you know. And Mr. Abrams was like, you know, looking, he was in his deep thoughts, you know, and this kind of thing. This kind of thing went on in the '60s a lot, right? You know, a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan, my good friend of many, many years. I remember we went hiking once with his sister Patty, and Patty was a really nice and very attractive young woman, And Larry told me that she got married and had two kids, and then she decided that that basically she was very unfulfilled, and she sort of like left, and her husband had to take care of the kids, and she you know, basically started a whole new life, and then that marriage didn't work out, and now she's going to China with her boyfriend, and she told her mother, "I think I finally found the man of my dreams," right? So, you know, I'm not criticizing her. This is just a very Western way of thinking, right? On the other hand, you know, I have a lot of Asian friends whose lives have already been decided for them by their families, you know, and it's like they aren't really adults until they're about 50. You know, I lived in Seattle for some of my life, and I knew a lot of these East Asian people. I had a friend named Adrian Chan, and Adrian told me she was never allowed to date until she finally left home with her advanced degree, and she was living on her own, and she was in her mid-30s, and her parents finally stopped trying to control her life. She said she was never able to go out on dates, and she couldn't, you know, they kept very strict control of her. And they were quite disappointed because she didn't get married and have kids, you know, and she pursued a career. And because I had asked her once, I said, "Well, did you date?" She said, "Date? Are you crazy?" You know, she had a very traditional Chinese family, and there was no dating. You know, that was... So, you know, I have met people who are from Asian backgrounds who feel, you know, like this oppressive weight of expectations, you know, and you know, people who basically, you know, pretty much live their lives determined by their parents. And some of them turn out to be happy, you know, some of them turn out to be very, very unhappy, you know. So this is like two different ideas, right? One is that we need to struggle and become a true free individual. And the other is that we have this problem with isolation, that we're very isolated, and we need to somehow find a way to be together, you know, to have a community. And it's possible to say these don't fit together, but I think both of these are important aspects of life. I think somehow we have to make them fit together. That basically this koan is kind of talking about trying to make them fit together. You know, the individual freedom and fulfillment and social connection. You know, these two things somehow seem contradictory, but somehow we have to bring them together. You know, so this is the last day of Sesshin, right? And we have been together as individuals cultivating awakened mind. And nobody can have enlightenment or even a moment of insight for you, right? It's not something that can be produced communally. You know, when one person has Daikensho, everybody else doesn't go suddenly, "Huh? Wow!" You know, that doesn't happen. There is no such thing as like a collective mind in that sense, you know. And the Buddha used to say, I wish I could automatically make you enlightened, but I can't. Unfortunately, you're going to have to sit down on the cushion and do all this zazen and work through your obstacles. And, you know, he just said, basically, you know, be courageous about it and do it, you know. Work out your liberation with diligence, basically. Those are some of his last words. It was, you know, work out your liberation with diligence, you know. So, you know, you have to do it as an individual, and this is very, very important. Nobody can do it for you. And, you know, basically we all struggle with our own shadows. I talked earlier about how we struggle. Each of us has our own shadows, you know. And it seems to me that for many people in the modern world, even if they're Westerners, the biggest problem is lack of confidence in the self. And I don't mean the personal self, but I mean the big self. You know, so even in a culture like ours where people are told that they have to, be themselves, you know, they still have a lot of self-distrust and a lot of self-loathing, you know. So a really important part of Zen practice is this idea of learning how to trust the big self. This is so important. Most people are scared to be themselves. They're scared to be natural. They second guess themselves every step of the way. This is true. This is, I was talking a little earlier in the week about a person who basically was gay, but didn't want to be gay, and the agony he went through, trying actually to be the straight male that his parents wanted him to be, and the shame he felt, and the horrible frustration that he felt, and even to the point of wanting to commit suicide. You know, this is actually quite common among young gay men, the role is, be straight, et cetera, and they can't fit the social role without doing great violence to themselves. And so they contemplate exiting. You know, that's quite, they have a higher than average suicide rate. So my friend had to have the confidence to, he had to trust his big mind. And Zen practice is really all about learning how to trust the big mind. And in a way, this is like not wearing your funeral clothes to your parents' funeral. You know, it's like I'm coming in my tennis clothes, you have to wear to the funeral the clothes that make you feel most alive, most compassionate, deeply connected. And it's going to have to be your compassion, your connection, your aliveness. This is a fact. And most people are unable to be free because of the power of their desires to please others, be acceptable, to be lovable, and so on. People usually, my experience is that people mostly imagine that if they took the brakes off themselves, if they let themselves out of the box, they'd turn into a murderer or something, or they'd, so people who, it's quite natural, for example, have sexual desire, and there are some people who are afraid of their desires. You know, they're actually terrified. And it's like if I start saying yes to sexual desire, I don't know where it will end. And what does that mean? I might want to sleep with a different person every day. You know, is that really what you want? Well, I might. Well, is it? Well, no, actually, no. I'm actually just looking for somebody to love, Okay, well then, so we're afraid. Maybe somebody's offended us, right? And, we're afraid to come in and say, you've really pissed me off. So we might actually think, my God, I might kill this person. You hear somebody say, I'm so mad I could kill so-and-so. And that's a complicated statement, I think, because it really means I'm afraid of my anger. See, I'm really afraid of my anger. And I'm afraid that if I let my anger go, I'll kill this person. When probably, if you let your anger go, you just yell at them, But there's this distrust of the self. I hope I'm making some sense, But But, you know, generally speaking, if we begin to trust the big mind, if we begin to trust the deep self with, what you know, with the educated heart, you know, things are going to be better. Our social, you know, we'll be happier, we'll be more fulfilled, and so on. So, you know, really, Sesshin is doing this, a lot of Sesshin is doing this kind of work of learning how to be trusting of our true nature, of our true nature. And actually not wearing the funeral clothes to the funeral, right? We kind of have to say goodbye to the dreams of our parents, you know, and we kind of have to be our own person. So there is a kind of individuation that goes on, you know, there really is. A lot of Zen training involves, you know, being a fully actualized individual. That's really true. So that's part of Zen practice, you know. But on the other hand, there's this other part of Zen practice too, which is discovering our relationships and our obligations and connections to other people. And I think that when we are really honest with ourselves, when we're really in touch with the true nature, which is very hard to do, and we're often not, we can be more compassionate, more generous, more kind and responsive to others. When we're uneasy with ourselves, when we distrust ourselves, we are often very hard for us to be responsive and trusting and kindly to others. I say this from personal experience. You know, I'm sure you've had this experience where, you know, somebody will say to you, "Would you quit walking back and forth? You're making me nervous." Well, actually, you're not making them nervous. They're already nervous, right? They're nervous, and that's why you're walking back and forth bothers them, you know. So I mean, if we're in a kind of turmoil ourselves, or if we're constantly keeping ourselves locked up or boxed in, it's very hard for us to respond spontaneously and in a compassionate way to others, you know. So my guess is that when we're liberating ourselves and we're allowing the true nature to operate freely, it's going to have a positive effect on our relationships to other people. You know, there's a great moment in Zen practice. It's one of the most important moments that can happen. You know, many people who start Zen practice are in a personal distress, you know. Something is bothering them. They may not even admit it, you know, but there's something that's troubling to them, and they come to Zen and they start practicing. And even though meditation is hard, somehow it helps them to feel better. They decide maybe one day to come to a sesshin. And they do a sesshin, and at some point, they enter into deep samadhi, and they experience the pure joy of deep samadhi. This is not so rare, right? This happens to people. You have all these pressures and all these burdens and all these inner demons you're struggling with, you know, and you're watching the breath, and all of a sudden there's like a clearing. And joy arises. You feel this spaciousness, and you feel this joy. And then, you know, it's not so uncommon in that moment for people to say something like, "I wish my mother could feel this joy." Or, "I wish, you know, if only my father had this experience, his life would have been so different." See? The word for that moment, to see that moment is you know, that might happen to you on the cushion. You might be in a kind of blissful experience, and then you think, "Oh, if only other people could experience this," you know. And then you might dismiss that thought and think it's unimportant. But actually, in Buddhism, that That moment is hugely important. The moment you are released from suffering, see, Buddhism basically says people are pretty decent, pretty good. So the idea is that when you're no longer in suffering, when you're no longer in hell, the first thing you think about, actually, after you enjoy not being in hell, is all the other people in hell. See, that's a very optimistic view of human beings, isn't it? It's like, once you're out of pain, you're going to, instead of saying, oh, I'm out of pain, screw everybody else, right? That's not what happens. You know, what happens to the human being when the human being is operating, when the person is liberated from distress and suffering, the first thing the human says is, oh my gosh, look at all the other people suffering. The word for that in Buddhism is bodhicitta, bodhicitta. At that moment, a person is on the bodhisattva path. So this is like hugely important for Buddhism. Because Buddhism says people are basically good. They're less likely to be good when they're struggling with their own fears and demons. You know, when we're haunted by our own ghosts, it's very hard to be responsive to others. But when we get clear of that, even for a second, the mind turns to others in distress and there's a natural desire to help. This is bodhicitta. That's really the first milestone in Zen practice is samadhi. And everybody who's practiced has experienced samadhi sooner or later. And it's bliss. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. I'm a little bit addicted to samadhi. I go around and say, how was your sit? You know, people, great. Oh, great. Oh. You know, so, but it is great. I love samadhi, I'll tell you. Sooner or later people realize, but what about all the people who aren't in samadhi? Now, you know, in every religion people have a desire to make converts, right? You know, this is not about making converts. You know, it's not about going out there and preaching the gospel of Buddha. It's not about religion, it's about people feeling pain and the desire to relieve their distress no matter what they believe or no matter who they are. So bodhicitta has nothing to do with wanting to make somebody a Buddhist. It has to do with the recognition of somebody's distress. When we are liberated from pain, our natural impulse is to want to help others. That's the teaching. And I believe it. I think it's true. Generally, people don't help others because they're in such distress themselves. So the idea that you know, first of all, it's not selfish to pursue enlightenment. That you will hear that argument. You know, you will hear that argument. I do not believe that. You know, the Confucianists in China did not like the Buddhists for a long time, or at least for the first 2,500 years, they didn't get along. Buddhism has put down deep roots in China because people realized, you know, actually people who are practicing the way are very compassionate and very sensitive to the suffering of others. In Chinese folk Buddhism, there's a saying that if somebody in your family has Daikensho, the positive benefits carry over to the family for 7 generations. See, so basically this is not an anti-social act, because when we wake up, our desire is to help others. And people who are not terrified by their own demons and tied up by their own knots are more likely to be helpful to others. So these two things don't seem to fit together, but they fit together, you know. Pursuing enlightenment is something you have to do as an individual. Nobody can do it for you. And, you know, people come into the Dokusan room as individuals. They don't come in as a group. And how are you all doing? Oh, we're all doing well. It's like a group session in therapy. You know, that's not going to happen. All three of them had a Daikensho at the same time. It was amazing. That's not going to happen. It's an individual experience. But on the other hand, you know, basically when you are out of suffering, Buddhism says that the moment of bodhicitta will occur. So after samadhi, bodhicitta, and that's the beginning of the bodhisattva's path. And it's true that nobody's totally out of suffering, right? So it's like, you know, you're in samadhi, you have bodhicitta, and then you set out to help others. You still have your own, you know, stuff to clean up. You still have problems, you know. But it's not a selfish act to seek enlightenment. The society will be better if more people are able to get to that level of clarity. That's the teaching. And even though China was originally opposed to Buddhism, it sort of realized, well, there's something to this. You know, later Confucianism actually incorporated a lot of Buddhism. And until the revolution in China, Buddhists and Confucianists, after thousands of years of conflict, actually had very good relations. These two things can harmonize, you know, actually. And must harmonize because we have to be, you know, we can't really be happy if everybody else is miserable, right? Part of our desire for happiness is the desire for others to be happy as well, and so our obligations to others are real. You know, it doesn't mean if your parents want you to be a doctor, you have to be a doctor, right? I regret many things in my life, but I don't regret ignoring my mother when she tried to push me into a medical career. I loved my mother. The older I got, the more I loved my mother, the more I valued her and her sacrifices. But I also know that I am very glad I've done some of the things I've done in my life, especially Zen. And I'm glad I didn't become a doctor. I don't think I would have been a very good doctor, you know, just living out her fantasy. It's not selfish to practice Zen. But there is this, and there is this social dimension. You know, when we leave the sesshin, you know, we confront a world of suffering and a world of distress, you know. And we have to try in our daily lives to manifest the freedom and joy we've experienced at the sesshin. And this is a new set of challenges. It's another kind of practice, and it's challenging. But it's essential to realize that the fruits of awakening happen in the world. This is where our practice comes to its fullest development in the frustrations of our interactions with other people, as sons and daughters, as boyfriends and girlfriends, as partners, life partners, as parents, as you know, employees, etc., etc. This is the practice on the cushion has to take this form, you have to come to the funeral in your tennis togs, but you still have to come to the funeral, right? It's very important, when we are able to diffuse the freedom we experience on the cushion with our interactions in the world, it's a deeper kind of realization. It's a deeper kind of fulfillment. This is the falling down drunk part. You know, when we're going through our lives pretending to be something we're not, that's a terrible situation. You know, so if you're a doctor, and I'm obsessed with doctors today. And yes, if you're a doctor and you don't want to be a doctor, every day you go to the office, it's torture, right? And you're just pretending to be a doctor, right? You know? And so, that's not a happy situation, and you probably should find another way to practice, to use your skills, right? Let's say you wanted to be a doctor and you became a doctor. And basically, every day you get up, you're going to go to your office, and the patients are going to be lined. The patients maybe they're lined up out the door. You know, you think, oh, if you don't want to be there, you think, oh crap, more of these patients. You know, when is lunch? You know, but if you want to be there, you think, oh, this is my fulfillment. You know, come on in. You know, what is it? You know, and you're prescribing medicines, and you're looking down people's throats with a popsicle stick, if they still do that, you know, peering through their ear with a little light, you know. You're in heaven, right? If you don't want to be a parent, you shouldn't be a parent. You know, there are people who really didn't want to be parents. They did it because it was expected, and they weren't parents. They were like the absent parents, right? You know, they're never there, right? And you know, basically the world is full of such people. On the other hand, there are people who, you know, like my sister. She is so happy. She's like, she is such a mother. It's almost terrifying. You know, and she loves her kids. She's so happy, you know. So she's falling down drunk, right? You know. So the idea is to try to match. You know, we don't get it all right, but to try to match up these two parts, you know. And if we can match it up, you know, even if it's tough, you know, it's not easy being a doctor. It's not easy being a mother. You know, it's not easy being whatever. But if you're matching up the two parts of your life, then you're falling down drunk with joy, you know. And there's still challenges, you know. That doesn't mean, you know, everything's going to be great, you know. It just means you've picked your challenges that are existentially important to you, right? Which is really important, you know. So, you know, there's some commentary on here. There's one thing, though, you know. This, you know, when you are involved in the world, it's very uncontrollable. And you don't have the kind of tight control you have in the sesshin, right? You know, the sesshin is like a controlled environment. And you can leave sesshin and think, okay, I'm going to practice compassion. I'm going to bring this calm to my job. And you get to your job and somebody's trying to get you fired for, you know, and they've been lying and whatever, you know. So this happens, right? But the thing is, this is like food for your practice. This is very, very, very important. The poem says, the pure household has no neighbors. See, the pure household has no neighbors. So if you can have a nice clean house, but there's no neighbors, you're going to be all by yourself, lonely. You know, so it's better to have a dirty house, you know, and have neighbors and have friends in the house. See, and there's a commentary I just wanted to read. You know, Kaohsiung said, crude, mundane greed, anger, and folly may be difficult to cut off, yet they are still the light. Crude anger, greed, and folly may be difficult to cut off, but they are still the light of enlightenment. He says, being unconcerned, and he says, unconcern and non-doing purity is a bigger sin than anything. Isn't that interesting? I mean, Buddhists don't use the word sin. I'm translating. But he said, the worst thing is to try to be pure and avoid complexity and engagement in life, right? So if you decide you want to be a parent, and you have an image of being a parent, right? And then, of course, if you're a parent, you're going to screw it all up. It's just guaranteed, right? And then you can say, why did I do this, right? I wanted to be the ideal parent, and instead my kids are in therapy, and I, you know, blah, 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 and, you know. And my son has decided not to be a doctor. But he says, you're not being in the world is a bigger flaw, bigger failure, is a bigger failure than any other failure, you know. I just think that's such an important, that's an important lesson, that that it would be better to actually, you know, be greedy and angry sometimes than not to try, right? The desire to stay above life or outside of life is really a very big failure, you know. So we're all going to leave the sesshin, and you know, we're going to go back into the world, and we're all going to have headaches and problems. And it's very important to see these issues as part of your practice, not an interruption of your practice. You know, you get back and maybe your house is a madhouse and you say, oh brother, you know, if only I were back at the sesshin, that's going to be a temptation. But what you really need to say is, okay, this is the next stage in my practice. I need to be present here 100% as I was present with my breath 100%. And I need to get out into the world where things are messy and confusing, and I'm going to get confused myself sometime, but I'm going to keep trying. And that is that's the two worlds, that's East and West, so to speak, coming together. That's the fulfillment of filial duty. You're yourself, but you're in the world helping others. Yes?